Great leaders need an uncommon desire for results to take charge, lead their teams, and accomplish the mission. They are critical for success in our volatile, uncertain times. Often they are called names like bully and jerk in our politically correct, overprotective culture. Your host is Jordan Goldrich, co-author of the Amazon best-selling book, Workplace Warrior, People Skills for the No Bullshit Executive. He is a chief operations officer, member of the Marshall Goldsmith MG100 Coaches, and a master corporate executive coach. If you want strategies for being completely authentic while you end the complaints, protect yourself and your team, and take performance to an even higher level, then welcome to the Workplace Warrior. Drive results without damaging relationships. And now, here's Jordan.
Welcome, everyone. Today, you will hear a deep and enlightening conversation at this time when there is political division over the concept of systemic racism. Our guests' stories articulate the importance of us all understanding how blocks to housing, banking, and business have mitigated the opportunity to amass generational wealth and create a meaningful quality of life for people of color. Our subject today is leading with inclusion, and our guest is Brenda Harrington. Brenda is a certified executive coach and founder of Adaptive Leadership Strategies, LLC. She works with leaders globally in public, private, government, intergovernmental, humanitarian, and nonprofit organizations. She spent more than 30 years in private industry in positions ranging from first-level management to senior executive leadership. She has countless firsthand experiences with issues involving diversity, both explicit and implied. And by the way, everybody, as we get into this, I read her book. She's got some incredible stories, not in terms of horrific, but in terms of really explaining what's going on today and what was going on back then. In her coaching practice, some of the circumstances she encounters with clients and within organizations involving diversity, inclusion, and acceptance mirror experiences she's had or been aware of over many years. She knows that in the absence of mentors and sponsors, challenges and obstacles can be much more formidable. And her term, when all you hear is that you can't or that you shouldn't, chances are that you don't and you won't. And she says, in many cases, can't means you can and shouldn't often means yes, you should. She's a graduate of Georgetown University Leadership Coaching Program and is a credentialed member of the International Coach Federation. She holds a master's degree from Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University, Pamplin College of Business, and a bachelor's degree from Adelphi University. Welcome, Brenda.
Thank you so much. Very nice to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here. And, you know, as I was telling you as we warmed up, I'm not the best reader in the world, but I got into your book because I wanted to be able to have a good interview. And boy, was it gripping and well-written. So I really want to acknowledge that.
I appreciate that. That means a lot. Thank you.
So as I read your book, you tell some incredible stories about your personal experiences in diversity, inclusion, and acceptance, and how these mirror experiences of some of your executive coaching clients. So I'd like you to please give our audience a little feel for your journey. And I'm thinking maybe the one that pops out was the one about your high school guidance counselor. And then, I don't know, perhaps Mobile, you know, being terminated at Mobile, but maybe there are some other ones.
Right. Well, the guidance counselor story was my sister, and I'm happy to share that. That was the launch pad, actually, for, I'll say, my activism, if you will. And Mobile, I resigned, you know, from Mobile. I wasn't terminated, but I did have I talk about a settlement with AT&T in the book. So that was,
You know, there were so many stories I have got there.
I know. Yeah, no, that's okay. And I'm grateful that you took the time. I know you have a lot of people that you're working with, so it means a lot to me that you took time to read the book. And so, you know, the story about the high school guidance counselor really, in my mind, is kind of the launch pad where some of this starts for us. And certainly at that point in time, and I'm talking about the 1960s, it was probably more widely accepted. But I would argue, based on the things that I hear and I see with friends and colleagues, that a lot of it is going on today. And basically, this was a case of a young woman who had never wanted to be anything more than a nurse. And, you know, we look to our counselors and our advisors to help to guide us and to prepare us for career development and advancement. And the messaging she got at that time was, oh, no, you shouldn't think about being a nurse. But if it's the white uniform you like, then maybe catering or being a hairdresser will be appropriate for you.
That was pretty incredible when I read that.
Yeah, no. And that young woman is my sister, my older sister. And fast forward about 4 or 5 years when she graduated from nursing school as a registered nurse. In those days, registered nurses wore white caps with black bands to indicate that they were RNs, not LPNs. I took a picture of her to school with me. I was then at the same school where this had taken place. And I shared it with that same counselor. And I said, you were wrong. I said, you told my sister that she couldn't become a nurse, and she has. And so I don't know how I wasn't escorted out or anything like that, but no such thing ensued.
I take it the guidance counselor didn't say thank you for the feedback.
She just kind of sat there. Yeah, I don't think she really knew what to say. Yeah, she just kind of sat there, and I left the office. So yeah, but it really that's when so many lights came on for me. You know that there were such hard distinctions. And I will share with you, fast forward 20, 30, 40 years, my sister has gone back for reunions and had conversations with her classmates. And other minority classmates have shared that they had the same experience. And white classmates, like you're saying, you know, said, oh, I had no idea that was happening. You know, and they really were, there were really hard distinctions in the types of guidance and advice that they received. So, and we were not in the South. You know, a lot of people think that all of these things are limited to south of the Mason-Dixon line. We were in Mount Vernon, New York. So there you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So what, another story from your work life?
Another story from my work life. You know, the thing that I really wanted to drive home with the book overall was that there are realities that people are unaware of, and it depends on which side of, you know, a circumstance that you're on. Certainly, if you're being impacted by particular circumstances, you have choices to make with regard to how you respond or whether you respond at all and just, you know, take it in. On the other side, there are profound blind spots. And, you know, as you're saying now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I surmise that, you know, some things might have been a surprise to you in reading the book that you just were not aware of. And so,
yeah, you know, absolutely, that is true.
So. Yeah, okay, thank you. And so, you know, one of the stories that really stands out to me is, you asked about a story of my work life, so I'll tell this. There's certainly many other very compelling stories in the book.
But well, by the way, feel free, if there's a more compelling story, feel free to go for it.
Well, I think that this one is important because, you know, here I am. I was a senior executive in an organization, a member of the executive team, and we would go on these annual retreats. And every year, you know, we would go off into, you know, no man's land to spend 2 or 3 days together. And there was certainly no shortage of information and material that we could have covered related to the business. But the CEO, you know, which often treat these outings as a family vacation. And one year we went to Richmond, Virginia, to go on a tour of antebellum architecture and do all these things that were related to the Civil War and before. And I respectfully excused myself from most of those activities. And I let him know up front that, you know, I didn't feel it was appropriate and I didn't want to be part of it. As much as I did to protect myself, I still ended up in front of a train, if you will. Because one of those nights, we were visited by an actor in character, as George Washington, who was talking about the Revolutionary War. And here I am, the only Black person in the room of 30 or 35 colleagues. And George says, you know, we had no choice but to go to war against the British. Otherwise, we would have been relegated to slavery, just like those Blacks. And, you know, I felt like I had been hit between the eyes. It was such a gut punch. And so a lot of things happened. I ended up leaving the retreat early, things like that. And, you know, we got into a conversation about it, you know, but in his eyes, you know, it's just history, you know, and he had no sensitivity to, you know, how that might have impacted not just me, but anyone else, because others then came forward and said, you know, how that it made them uncomfortable and that they felt that it was not really appropriate for a business setting. So those kinds of things. There's just a lack of, and it's not malicious. Let me say that. It's not always malicious, certainly. I know he didn't intend to, you know, for that to have the impact that it did on me. But there's such little regard in so many cases. And when you are, I refer to that story in that chapter, The Lonely Only, right? And when you're the only one always trying to make others comfortable and make sure that you're fitting in, and the reality is it's inachievable.
Yeah. So really what struck me is, first of all, having grown up in New York City and been educated in public education in New York City all the way through, and grown up among people who were very much in support of Martin Luther King and thought that slavery and and what followed was really bad, I thought I had a pretty good education. And, you know, recently a friend of mine shared with me, somebody who, well, I grew up in the City Housing Project. I think I mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And he also grew up in the City Housing Project. He's a Black guy, or was when he was young. And he's now a retired educator in New York. Anyway, he sent, he posted a story about after World War II, the government gave very low interest loans to returning GIs unless the house they wanted to buy was in a Black neighborhood.
You know, redlining. Yeah.
And I totally had never heard of that. I had never heard of, I certainly in recent times had never heard of the Tulsa race massacre. And I had seen a show about Mary W. Jackson, which you talk about in your book, the Black female engineer who played a critical role in helping NASA getting into space. And I remember seeing that, and even then it didn't strike me. How come I didn't learn about that? Yeah. You know, so I think one of the real key things in these times is, I don't know if you agree with this, it does feel to me from when I grew up that we've made a lot of progress in terms of race and gender and all that stuff, but that there's still a lot of stuff, and there are a lot of people who just don't understand the context.
They don't understand the context, and they don't understand the consequences. And what I mean by that is that a lot of people like to think that, okay, slavery is history, it's over with, let's move on. But what you talk about with regard to, you know, barriers to entry into the housing market, and, you know, you can apply that to banking and business and so many other aspects of life, it really mitigates, almost eliminates the opportunity to amass generational wealth and to really, you know, create a meaningful quality of life. And so this perpetual struggle, yes, on the face of it, it looks like, you know, there has been a lot of progress, and a lot of people, the first thing people go for is the low hanging fruit, right? Well, we've had a Black president. Yeah, that's great. But you still have neighborhood after neighborhood after neighborhood in every, certainly every major city across the country where there are deep fractures. And I would invite you and your listeners respectfully to, look up a series called Driving While Black, and it talks about the divisions created by the highway system in the United States, all of the throughways and the highways that just obliterated Black neighborhoods as the national highway system was being constructed. So all of those things really put a group of people, an entire group of people, at a tremendous disadvantage.
Okay. So Driving While Black.
Yes.
It's a series or a book or?
It's a series on public television.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me take a break for a moment.
Yes.
Because I want to let everyone know about Brenda's book, which we've been talking about. But I just want to say Access Denied is intended to provide people of color and members of minoritized and marginalized groups with tools to navigate their circumstances more effectively. And it is an honest, unabridged commentary on what minorities experience, how it makes them feel, and the impact our experiences or their experiences can have on quality of life. And you can learn more about Access Denied at, this is going to be a long one, so hold on, it'll also be in the show notes. https://access-denied.net. And I also wanted to ask you about something else that I saw in the book. There was something about conversations at access-denied.net. What is that about?
Conversations is an opportunity for people to kind of raise their hand. Because one of the challenges of being in a situation, some of the situations as those described in the book, is loneliness and the mm-hmm. feeling that, you know, there's really no one else to engage with, or, you know, who understands what you're experiencing. And so through conversations, I'm inviting people to join discussion forums and groups to be able to process some of these things. You know, it's about being able to make choices, at least starting with knowing that you have choices to make.
Sure.
and setting meaningful expectations. Yeah. So I'm really looking to create a community.
Okay. And so people can be part of that as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Okay. So when they go to the website for the book, there's a place to sign up and provide your information. Yes.
Okay. Super. So I also want to mention that the Workplace Warrior podcast is sponsored by Workplace Warrior, Inc. We partner with strong, successful leaders to be completely authentic while they accomplish their mission and take results to an even higher level. If you're an executive who would like to have a complimentary conversation about driving results without damaging relationships, you can contact me at jordan@jordangoldrich.com. So, another thing that caught me from your book, I believe it was your friend and colleague May, and I didn't quite get her last name, or I'm not remembering it, but she was talking about she made a comment that the uphill path leading to the goal of compassion, and I think she was talking about from a history of slavery, racism, bias, requires admission of the enormity of the work done. And what stood out for me about that is the argument we're having today about teaching systemic racism in schools. And what really struck me was, having grown up in the New York school I grew up in and thinking I had a great broad education about this, was how much I didn't hear. Like, for instance, when I heard about the Tulsa massacre,
right,
that was totally new for me. And, you know, I also hadn't heard about Mary W. Jackson, the Black female engineer who played a critical role in helping NASA get into space. And, you know, that was on TV. And there were a number of things I've heard in the last few years that really surprised me. And apparently your friend and colleague May made a comment that the reason this stuff should be dealt with and not gone over is sort of like step one in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have to at least acknowledge what's been done if you're going to heal from it.
Right.
And that really struck me as a important comment in this day and age when people are saying, you know, it's healed, you know, it's gotten a lot better, and it probably has, but still there's focus, you know, there's need to hear what the history is.
Right. No, I think that we need to hear about all of our history. And, it troubles me that we make this distinction between American history, Black history, we have Hispanic History Month, all these other things. It's all American history. It's part of our story. There are an awful lot of people, unfortunately, that don't want to hear anything beyond, what they learned in school many years ago, and they want to roll things back, okay? And some of that, a lot of that is about power and privilege, but we're not unified in any way in that regard. It's no surprise to you or your listeners, and so that's the most troubling thing I think right now, is that there are a lot of people for whom this is not an issue, or they don't think it's an issue, and that things are fine the way they are.
Yeah. So taking that a little bit further, I remember when I first heard the term defund the police. It just struck me as one of the worst political terms I have ever heard. And there's a, you know, for me, the term systemic racism is really about teaching all of the stuff that we're talking about, the real history, so people know what happened. And it could be related to that Alcoholics Anonymous first step of admitting the enormity of what's happened and what's still there. I'm curious what you think about the term systemic racism. And well, I'm curious about what you think about the term systemic racism.
I think that it oversimplifies perhaps, where we are. Other words that come to mind other than systemic are pervasive. I do think that maybe not, I won't say that racism is ubiquitous, but matters associated with race are ubiquitous because it shows up in ways that you couldn't imagine, in places that you just it just wouldn't even occur to you. And so I don't, it's difficult for me to explain all the places that it ha can and have impact. And I realize, the term systemic sounds harsh, but just the example that you used, with regard to the GI loans after World War II, it really has impact. It has impacted so many of our social, political, and legal systems. And you don't know unless you're impacted by it.
Yeah, and what's popping up for me is I heard a recently, and I would be more prepared if I had thought about bringing this up, but I didn't. But apparently, the NFL had a different has had a different set of rules around black players who are injured or who have concussions or what have you than white players. Are you aware of that?
I am absolutely aware of that.
Yeah. What's that about?
Well, I think that there is a model or a guideline that is used by the medical community, the doctors and the trainers within the NFL, to determine the degree or the significance of a person's injury, after retirement, based on their experience, while active in the NFL. And they had a different metric for black players, who now dominate the league, by the way, than for white players, based on the assumption, okay, that black players started at a lesser degree of cognitive ability.
Wow, that's incredible.
So there's a different base, there was a different baseline, basically.
Yeah. Well, I guess that would be an example of systemic racism. I keep thinking, like, what could a better term be? Or I don't know. Anyway, let's let it go. We could go on forever. Anyway, I would love to hear. You talk in your book about schemas, and I'm a former therapist, so I know about schemas, but tell our audience a little bit about schemas and what they are.
Well, it basically is an underlying premise, and you probably are better to explain this than me. I provided kind of a layman's definition in the book, But I think it's important because, and this is a perfect segue from what we just talked about with the NFL, because it's an underlying belief that informs how we think about the world around us, how we think about people and things like that. And so if you believe that a particular group of people is, you know, is inferior, you know, either, well, is not as smart, let's say, doesn't have the same, you know, level of sure. intellect or aptitude, right? If that's your belief, then that schema informs your, you know, everything that you come to know and the way you interact with everybody who's part of that group.
Yes.
You know, and I will listen, I'll raise my hand and say, and I don't know how you feel about this as a fellow former New Yorker, my first exposure to people in the South was on television. The Beverly Hillbillies, the Andy Griffith Show, Gomer sure. Pyle, okay? And so my first impression of people with Southern accents was that they were not smart, okay? Awful, awful, all right? But it wasn't until, you know, I grew up and started to peel that back that I realized that was, you know, their accent, you know, the region of the country that they were from had nothing to do with their aptitude or their intellect, you know. But that's a kind of the schema that informed my way of thinking about people who sounded like that.
Right, because New Yorkers who are smart talk quickly, they make their point.
Forget about it. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah, when I moved to St. Louis, my boss, who was born in one of the rural, born and raised in one of the rural Missouri towns, pulled me aside and said, listen, if they were sending me all over the Midwest. And he said, listen, if you're going to hang out with country people, you got to learn how to talk country. And for the next 2 months, he wouldn't do anything but talk country to me. So I'd walk in the morning, he'd say, well, Jordan, how you doing? I'd say, well, Rick, I'm doing just fine. And and then one day, this was back in the days when we still had phones with speakers in them, you know, I had a client from the Dallas area who was an older Texas guy. And I had been trying to connect with him. We had been missing each other, and Rick was in my office. And the phone rang, and the receptionist said, so-and-so's on the line. And Rick said, put it on speakerphone. So I put it on speakerphone, and I hear this guy say, well, Jordan, this is, I can't even remember his name, so-and-so from Texas, how are you doing? And I said, well, I am doing just fine. You know, and we went back and forth four or five times, and we connected. And after I hung up, Rick said, okay, you graduated. it was a good moment.
Yeah.
And by the way, this guy was incredible. He was working for a company. I don't even know if they're still there, called NCR. He was like a regional vice president or something. He was a yeah. heavyweight. The other part of that story that I love is when I get down there to talk with his people, he's got this, you know, pinstripe suit on with a bowler tie and boots. And he's twice my size, and he sticks out his hand to shake my hand, and it's twice my hand size. And as we walk down the hall, he puts his arm around my shoulder and he says, Jordan, the fellas are waiting to hear from you. And, you know, the New Yorker in me went, excuse me, you don't know me. And then I realized Rick made his point. I've got it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that was a really important show of trust for people to see him embrace you that way.
Yes.
You know, and, you know, that shows up a lot in my global and international work. Also, those little nuances that we have to pay attention to.
Sure.
But we've got more than enough, as is said in the South, to say grace over here
yes.
in the U.S. that we don't pay attention to. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I really enjoyed about your book for two reasons. One is the piece was very well done, but also there's a piece that you do on tools for people who are marginalized. And what really struck me is how much, well, because of the situation, it's very different for them, but how much it was for anybody who's struggling with being okay in another culture. It was really, really across the board. So Talk a little bit about the tools that you use in helping your clients deal with the blind spots around them.
Yeah. Well, first we've got to explore whatever fears might be present, you know, what they feel is at risk, what their level of confidence is, what their triggers are, because all of those things will inform what's possible for them. We also have to think about realistic expectations. You know, we tend to focus on ourselves. You know, we've got the degree, we've got the experience, we've got the credentials. So certainly I should be able to do this, but you've really got to read the room. You've got to understand the culture of the organization and the environment and who the power players are. And then you know what kind of conversation you're able to have. But you really do have to be ready to take some risks. And that's why I included the exercises and the questions, which are mostly introspective.
Yes.
Because people need to be honest with themselves about what they're dealing with. And it has less to do with them and everything to do with the environment that they're in.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say in there, and you know, I say this to people all the time, I said, sometimes it seems like people are trying to play soccer on a baseball diamond, right? Because what you're doing has, you know, whatever you're engaged with has nothing to do with the space.
Yeah.
And so you've got to find the alignment between those two things.
Yeah. What one of the things that I find as an executive coach with people of all different backgrounds is that they all need to learn how to read a room. A lot of times I do a lot of work with scientists and part of the, you know, who have been promoted into executive positions. And one of the big issues I've seen is that scientists talk like as if they are writing an article for a journal. They start off with the problem, and then they talk about blah, 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 blah. And then they talk about what they've tried. And then they reach their conclusion, which is we don't know everything. And it drives executives crazy, particularly sales executives and chief operations officers. You know, you got to start with the punchline. This is what I think. This is my conclusion. And I'm wondering how much of it is that you come up with people who are marginalized and we're also dealing with the cultural issues of being Black or et cetera. How much of it is learning just how to speak differently to executives versus also the bias that's in the room?
Understanding the audience. Absolutely. That's a huge part of it. But most of that, here's the thing. So we're going back to that word that I know you're not crazy about, but the systemic piece.
By the way, I have no problem with it. I'm just aware that a lot of people don't like it, and I'm trying to figure out what would be a better word.
Right. Well, they don't like the discomfort of it, but it's the reality of it. It's the truth. So I think it's the discomfort that many people struggle with. But you have to understand what's possible. And that varies from team to team, from organization to organization. And really understanding what kind of conversation you're able to have, in my opinion, and you tell me if you agree or not, begins with the end. What's important to the other person? What's in it for them?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay? And so if you're in an organization talking about, you know, the need for increased diversity and inclusion, and they don't see a value in that, you know, then you have to question whether or not, one, you're in the right place, and two, what kind of conversation you can is realistic. You know, there are organizations that aspire to, you know, to get to a place where their staff and their associates reflect their client base. What does that do for market share? What does that do for the business case? All of those kinds of things. So you really have to come up with a strategy. And it's less about, you know, it moves far and away from the issue of diversity and race and nationality or ethnicity, and really about what's best for the collective.
Yes. Yeah. And I really want to reinforce what you said about finding out what's important to that person. What are their key goals and what keeps them up at night? So one of the things that you do mention is the importance of having mentors and people you talk to. And one of the things that I do usually, well, I use a process called Feed Forward, which I got from Marshall Goldsmith.
Love it.
Yeah. And it's really around, this is my goal. And it could be my goal is to get promoted, or my goal, you know, perhaps is to be seen as a very effective leader. And do you think I'm working on the right goal? And do you have any suggestions? And, you know, if you were to do that with people first that you trust, and then people that they say you should talk to, eventually you're going to hear things like, you know, when you get up in front of the room and everybody's talking, rather than starting with this, you might want to start with that, because that's what's important to the CEO. And it right. really is a matter of speaking another language would be a good way to say it. So,
absolutely. We'll have to talk some other time about how we administer feed forward, because I've used it, you know, in a number of different settings. I use a lot of retreats and things like that, and I can't get people to stop. I mean, they just you know, want to spend so much time.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. No, it's yeah. great. It's very powerful.
I thought you were going to tell me I can't get them to do it.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah. I think it's a pretty benign way to get people to open up, people who would not otherwise communicate with each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, super. So I do notice that we're winding down a bit. This has been a wonderful conversation. And I'm wondering if you have any final thoughts for our listeners.
You know, the biggest thing I hope that people take away from this conversation is that it's so important to try to suspend judgment and to be curious. I do an exercise in multicultural settings called Beyond First Impressions. And it starts with introspection, you know, for you to really explore the things about yourself that are not conspicuous. That could be your religion, your marital status, you know, whether you're a parent, your hobbies and, you know, social activities. But the point is, think of all the things that people could not possibly know about you without getting to know you and peeling back the layers. And so then you have an opportunity to turn the tables and say, okay, what else could I possibly know about that other person other than their appearance, how they look?
Sure.
What assumptions and judgments am I making based on what I see, right? And so I encourage everyone to just be curious, keep an open mind, and strive to look for the places where we are alike and not always zero in on what appear to be our differences.
Yes. So if people want to get, by the way, I love it. I think I fully agree with you. So if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
I'm on Instagram as Author B. Harrington. That's a short way. You've shared the website for the book, which is access-deny.net. And my email address at Adaptive Leadership Strategies, what I call my day job, right, is bharrington@adaptiveleadershipstrategies.com. And I'm also on LinkedIn. If I can say one other thing too, also, the book is available on Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, Books a Million, and wherever books are sold. So they don't just have to go to the website to get the book. Yeah.
Yes. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate it. And, you know, thank you for being here.
Thank you. And thank you for taking time to explore the book. That means a lot to me. I appreciate it.
Well, I am going to be recommending it. So, yeah. So I want to remind everyone that, as she just said, Brenda's book, Access Denied, you can get it at https://access-denied.net. And also, there's the conversations at access-denied.net, which you can be part of. I also want to mention that the Workplace Warrior podcast is sponsored by Workplace Warrior, Inc. We partner with strong, successful leaders to be completely authentic while they accomplish their mission and take results to an even higher level. And if you're an executive who would like to have a complimentary conversation about driving results without damaging relationships, you can contact me at jordan@jordangoldrich.com. And I want to thank you all for listening and invite you to join us twice a month for an interesting and hopefully a challenging conversation about strong leadership and business success. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to Workplace Warrior, Drive Results Without Damaging Relationships. More information about today's episode, including show notes, can be found at workplacewarriorinc.com. Please rate and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts and share our podcast with any workplace warriors you know. Thanks again for listening.